You're listening to New Mexico Filmworks on Talk 1260 KTRC with your host, Dirk Norris.
Listening to New Mexico Filmworks on Talk 1260 KTRC Radio, brought to you by Hutton Broadcasting. My name is Dirk Norris, your host, and New Mexico Filmworks is a program of the New Mexico Film Office. Later in the hour, we're going to be talking to Erica Scharf, made a documentary about the Navajo folks, and we'll be talking to her from New York. But right now in the studio, I have Jennifer Harris and Scott Laidlow, who have done a documentary on why American students are failing at math called The Biggest Story Problem. Welcome to the studio.
Thanks, Dirk.
So, Scott, give us a little of your background, and then Jennifer, you can jump in with a little bit of your background.
Dirk, so my background was in teaching. I was a teacher for years. I taught teachers, pre-service teachers, before they would go into teaching, but I had not done it myself, and I felt compelled to do that before we kept sort of proselytizing the youth, I guess you might call it. So I got into teaching and taught for years in a little small public school in rural New Mexico up near Cuesta. Mm-hmm. And during that time, my students were performing fairly poorly in mathematics, and we were looking to do something to help change that. And so part of my background became building story-based games that would help teach mathematics where the math would make sense in those.
Terrific, in those games. Jennifer.
I actually have 17 years of corporate accounting background, and I think I just wanted to do something different, and I was attracted to Scott's work because, you know, I was always looking at our relationship with money and how a lot of confidence is, you know, people have issues, you know, with numbers and math, and kind of saw that correlation. And so when I saw his work, I'm like, hey, that's that foundation that's needed, you know, for students.
Yeah, I don't remember when I started learning about money, and I don't necessarily remember particular courses in it. I probably learned more from my parents than I did for, you know, anything at school. But it's interesting because, I mean, that's an integral part of our lives, and why not be teaching kids at the very beginning about what, you know, these little paper things are, and, you know, what it means to have more of them or less of them and that sort of thing.
Yeah, not to be afraid.
Yeah, yeah.
Of numbers.
All those numbers, you know, they scare me, but.
Yeah.
And you are both, you're up in Taos?
Yes.
Yeah. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, Scott, you created a game called Co's Journey. Want to talk to you a little bit about that, because the New Mexico Film Office is kind of emerging into or incorporating emerging media technologies. And this includes game building and visualization of scientific data and app building and all of that stuff. And so I know, and I keep talking about needing a new vocabulary, because when you say game, people think Call of Duty or something like that, which is not what you have developed. Do you use the term serious gaming or educational gaming or?
Well, I guess we use the term story-based game
story-based
to
game.
Teach content. And, you know, Ko is a girl in ancient wilderness, and she has mathematical challenges that make sense in that world. She saves a little wolf pup by mixing medicinal plants in particular ratios. And so the students would then assume the role of Ko, mm-hmm. this girl in encountering these challenges, where each one of those math problems, if you want to call them that, are layered quite deep into this story. And again, the idea here is that we'd have something that's coherent for them so that those students feel purpose.
And did you develop the whole thing, or did you have people that did the animation and storyline and the mathematics, or is it all you?
Oh, no, there's a whole team behind this, yeah. And the primary person on that team, right, of course, is Jen, as the producer of Ko's right. Journey, yes.
And what age group is this aimed at, if there is an age group?
6th and 7th grade, mm-hmm. 5th to 8th grade. We have some schools that have even used it later than that, 9th and 10th. But the primary aim or the primary content is sixth and seventh grade.
And the whole idea behind using a video game this way is kids don't necessarily learn the best sitting in a row in a 50-minute time period and going up to the chalkboard sort of thing, I'm assuming.
Not only do they, there's a lot of evidence, obviously, if we can look at, you know, how the United States is doing right now in mathematics. We're 25th out of 33 countries in terms of industrialized countries, and that would let us know that, no, our methodologies that we're currently using as a textbook standard deliver are not working.
Do you know how many other countries are using similar teaching techniques with the games?
I would say that the techniques that are being used in other countries are less game-oriented. There are other countries that are using situational cognition, if you want to call it that, where they're able to see math in a situation, I guess, where it would make sense, but it may not be in a game per se.
Okay. And Jennifer, does Co have money? Does she deal with economics?
No, she's dealing more with weight and stones.
Okay. So what was your participation in Co's journey?
I think my, I guess, biggest influence was making it for girls to be able to actually have a heroine, you know, because so many math games are more made for young boys, and just to have something for, you know, with girls wanting, you know, to feel confident again in math, and then how that confidence lends to, you know, being confident in managing money. So that was, I think, probably my biggest kind of making sure that stays in there.
Right, right. And that's really important. There's this whole discussion about lack of women in technologies and the whole STEM stuff, right?
Yeah.
Science, engineering, technology, and math. And I think that's brilliant to incorporate that in a young gal that's making this journey. Have you played it yourself?
I have. My mother played. My mother played, who said, "Oh, I'm not going to be able to do this." And all of a sudden she's like, "Okay, I got it. So it was really, really fun to see a 65-year-old woman.
Oh.
I got it.
Yeah, and be excited, right?
Yeah,
yeah,
absolutely.
That's terrific. Are there, is there an end to it? Are there levels? How does that work?
There are no levels to it, Dirk. In fact, it's a 15-hour story-based game. So a teacher might use it an hour a day in a classroom for 15 days. And then when they reach the end of it, they have completed their journey. But there is an end to it. And anyway, we could go through that. But she ends up completing her rite of passage, which is something, of course, that we are typically missing in our current culture today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. And her meaning the students that are actually participating in the storyline.
Right.
Do they get a grade at the end of it?
Well, one of the things
in quote marks, what grade?
Right. So one of the things that we have strictly avoided, in fact, this is part of the film that we'll get to later, is giving a student a grade per se. We have in the United States a little bit of an overemphasis on grades, on giving a reward or a sticker. And what we find is that students who are going after those types of rewards, whether it be a grade or a sticker or a candy bar, all of those extrinsic motivators have the same effect in that they demotivate students intrinsically.
Mm-hmm.
By seeing math in a location or situation where it makes sense to them, maybe for the first time, they're able to now feel like math has a purpose or is coherent. When they're done, we suggest to teachers that they get sort of a pass-fail. You've either done it or you have not.
Mm-hmm. It just makes sense to me that you learn in an environment where what you're learning about is around you, and so that's what this story-based game does. It puts you in an environment where you have to figure things out based on math, right? I hope I can play it someday.
You can play it. Okay. Mom did it.
I was 30 when I started college, and when I took the equivalency exams to do the required math, I had to take remedial math, and you know, this is a plus sign, this is a minus sign, to kind of get it all back in my head. So, So what was the transition, or was it a transition from Coe's journey into this documentary? Jennifer?
They put me on the spot because they know I'm shy.
Yeah.
The transition, basically, we had won a grant with the Next Generation Learning Challenges that's funded by the Gates Foundation. And we, as part of our, you know, the grant proposal, we said that we would document the pilot program of Coe's. And we took Coe's out to 10 different pilot schools. And at the same time, we wanted to actually really dig into the problems, you know, deeper than the level of the surface, oh, it's the teachers, or oh, it's money, not enough money. Like, we wanted to, really, what's going on? What are the tools, you know, in the day-to-day environment? What are the teachers working with? And I don't know, I think we got there.
Terrific. And what quickly, what are the 10 schools you went to?
The 10 schools are all over the United States, and they are in the locations are in South Carolina, Los Angeles, New York City. We've got a couple of schools in New Mexico.
And one in Arizona.
Arizona as well. And I think does that cover the map?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Did you get New York?
New York, yeah.
Okay, terrific.
Florida.
We're going to continue this conversation in our second segment. You've been listening to Talk 1260 KTRC Radio. This is New Mexico Film Works. And I've been speaking with Scott Laidlow and Jennifer Harris about their story-based game, Coe's Journey, which you can find online, information about that, which we'll talk about in a little bit, and their documentary, The Biggest Story Problem. We'll be back in just a minute. You're listening to Talk 1260 KTRC Radio. I'm your host, Dirk Norris, and I'm speaking with Jennifer Harris and Scott Laidlow. Came down from Taos today, and we're talking about their documentary, The Biggest Story Problem, about why kids aren't learning math, and documenting the effectiveness of Coe's Journey. Is that kind of the...
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So 10 cities that you went to do this documentation. How did you pick the locations, or were they picked for you?
Well, Dirk, we wanted to have national coverage, so we started with trying to get into some of the biggest school districts, Los Angeles Unified, all the way to New York City. So that's the central idea, was that we wouldn't just be looking at populations in one particular state. From there, it took a lot of help. We asked for help with a lot of folks, and we were very fortunate in that the technology director from LA Unified contacted us first.
Oh, great.
But there were some other locations where in New York City we got help with some folks that work with schools and got us connected.
Terrific. And how was it filming in the schools? Was it difficult kind of being recording all this and not being a part of it, so to speak?
I think being, the first thing is that it's a very rare opportunity to be able to film in schools. Mm. It's not something that you can just walk in and expect it to happen. We have coverage from every single pilot school that we worked with, and that really helped us gain insight into what's happening across the United States and nationally in the way that we teach math.
Right.
Really broad spectrum of how the different approaches and so on. But in terms of was it hard, I think the hardest thing is that, you know, you've got hundreds of permissions to gain before you can.
Right. Yeah, all that paperwork.
Yeah.
Right. Did you take a crew with you throughout the whole project, or did you pick up crews in the different locations?
A little of both.
Uh-huh.
Alex Usatine of High Desert Digital, locally here, he came with us. He actually went to Finland with Scott and in the dead of winter.
Perfect time to go.
That's right, yeah. So I opted on the summer trip.
Okay.
And, but we'd also just hire out and just, hey, could you come, shoot for the day?
Right. How many crew typically?
We had, crew members, we'd had 1 to 2. It was very, very small.
Right.
Very small budget film, but we did a lot with it. So the accounting came in helpful.
Oh, yeah, right. As always, it gets down to the numbers. How much did you shoot? I mean, how much, how long, how many minutes or hours of film did you do?
I think it was 100 hours of footage.
Okay. And the movie is...
At least, yeah.
Yeah, and edited down to how long?
82 minutes.
82 minutes, yeah. See, to me, that's just a phenomenal effort. Did you guys do the editing, or you had somebody else come in?
Alex Dusatine and then David Aubrey.
Okay.
Leaned on his expertise a lot.
Yeah. So, yeah, filing all that stuff, because it's hard to get rid of, you know, stuff, right? This is good, but we can't, you know, we don't have enough time. Or, yeah. So what did you, how did the students react to all this?
They were excited.
Yeah, I think they were excited. You see a couple of them a little shy in the film where they're covering their faces, but for the most part, most of them really enjoyed speaking to it. And, you know, we were obviously appreciative that they would allow us into their space, but I think, you know, they're otherwise in their typical school classroom, breaks up the day a little bit for them. To see a film crew, right? And a boom mic going around. Right. Oh, this must be a special day.
Right. So how did you approach this? The kids played the game, and then you interviewed them afterwards, or you film them while they're playing the game? How did that work?
Tried to film in all situations, gaining an insight into what's their typical day like. We even filmed two of the girls in their, you know, in their homes, and they're both in Los Angeles. And they've both been struggling in mathematics. That's how the film opens, is that they've had a hard time up to this point, really. And very difficult subject for them. And so we capture them in their homes and all the way through the whole school day.
All right. So what were the reactions from the kids?
For the game overall? I think Co was something that they reacted to very positively. Mm-hmm. A lot of the challenges that we faced were technical challenges in getting it into the schools. Slow bandwidth was a major factor.
Oh, sure.
All the students are sharing it, so they're waiting, and those parts are disappointments. Once they're over the initial hurdles, the kids are literally almost kind of lit up. You're excited to see this.
Mm-hmm.
And that part to it, I think, really was amazing. We did not know that before we got going, whether they were going to like it or not.
Right. Well, that's certainly a lot of validation. I mean, if kids are enthused and like it, then they're going to be learning, right? Yeah. So how was it as you're filming? Were there things that happened that you didn't expect as far as the kids and, I mean, they're throwing signs and, you know, goofing off, and you have to tell them to settle down, or?
No, they're pretty polite. I think what surprised me is some of the schools we went into, like Sabita up in Shiprock.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they said, well, normally, you know, this culture is very, you know, shy. We got in there like, hey, and this one girl dressed up as Co. And I mean, they were so excited. They were just so excited. So it was, I mean, there's those type of surprises, you know, that were, people were really engaged. It was fun.
And when did you do this? When was the filming done?
We started recording in September at a teacher forum that we had in Taos, and then we did the 10 schools over the school year.
And have you done follow-up?
So
yes, almost constantly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And what kind of results are you seeing?
We aren't. We can't make any claims yet. We're doing a so-called, a very technical white paper, I guess you might call it. Uh-huh. And we really need to see those results. The results with the kids are that we've seen this be successful, and we're really happy about that. And now whether there's some big grand improvement in their test scores, we don't know until we've done due diligence with that.
Right. And future projects, anything in the plans, another story-based?
There's another story-based game that we're working on. We just won a federal grant, a phase one federal grant from Small Business Innovation Research, and that's a multiplayer game, again, and this one's set in ancient Mesopotamia at the dawn of civilization and the beginnings of economy. It's been Jen's been looking at that.
Thumbs up.
That's right. And in terms of economy, you know, you asked about surprises. One of the biggest surprises, Jen had mentioned, you know, maybe more than a dozen times, she said, I wonder if there's a relationship between mathematics and money. Mm. And one of the biggest findings that we have in the entire film is that those countries that they call the pigs, Portugal, Italy, Ireland, Greece, and Spain,
right,
are where they have financial problems. All of those are at the bottom of the OECD, and they are in mathematics. And the United States is right there with
right
them.
Right there with them.
Yeah.
Terrific. Tell people, we got to run. Tell people where they can find out more information, when the film is going to be around.
So The Biggest Story Problem, www.thebiggeststoryproblem.com is okay. The location. And in addition to that, we'll be doing an Albuquerque showing at the end of August, and folks can contact us on the website to find out the date and location.
I really appreciate you guys being in. Thanks.
Thank you.
You've been listening to New Mexico Film Works on Talk 1260 KTRC. We'll be back in just a minute.
Does it take your breath away and you feel yourself suffer?
This is New Mexico Film Works on Talk 1260 KTRC Radio. I'm your host, Dirk Norris, and we're speaking with Erica Scharf, who created a movie called Up Heartbreak Hill. She's currently producer of HGTV's popular series House Hunters International. She's the director, producer, and cinematographer of Up Heartbreak Hill, a feature documentary about three Navajo teens struggling to decide if they will stay on the reservation or leave after high school. Welcome, Erica.
Hi, so nice to be here.
Yeah, thanks. You had a wonderful showing. You showed the movie at the Chemo Theater last week. It was a terrific crowd. Really enjoyed the movie, but it turned out to be a movie different than what you had planned on, didn't it?
Yeah, you know, when I first began making the film, I had envisioned it being more focused on running and on the role that running played in these kids' lives and in Native culture. And running is still certainly a part of the film, but as I kind of got more into production, I realized that there was a much larger story about this generation and the struggles that these kids face in deciding if they're going to stay on the reservation or leave, and, you know, what the implications of that are for their community and for themselves and for their families.
Once you made that realization, was it easy to make kind of the transition and the theme of the film, or did you have to kind of work it a little bit?
Yeah, it was easy. And I mean, I think that the reason that I realized that there was that larger story is because the things that I were filming were so much broader than just, you know, a tale about running or, you know, aspiring to a state championship. I mean, those things were factors and parts of the story, but everything I was filming, when I was seeing, you know, Thomas, Tamara, and Gabby, the three kids, with their families, with their peers in the community, pointed to a much larger story. And so I was sort of already telling that story and already creating that story.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, it was just sort of realizing that I wanted to use all of that and really allow these kids to kind of share their perspectives and kind of show everybody what it's like to grow up on the reservation and feel that real connection to the land and to the earth and the community, and also want to pursue dreams of their own and sort of figure out how to strike that balance.
Sure. How did you end up selecting Navajo, New Mexico, and these particular kids?
Initially, I had made a scouting trip to the Navajo Nation, to the reservation, and visited about four or five different communities,
mm-hmm.
All of whom I had been in touch with and spoken to high school principals and coaches who all thought that they had students that would be interested in participating. So I met with about 30 or 40 kids, but Navajo, the town of Navajo, was actually the first place that I visited, and I just really fell in love with the community. Thomas was one of the first kids I met, and he's just so well-spoken, so open, so compelling,
mm-hmm.
and I thought the dynamic between him and his dad was really fascinating, and so I was kind of always drawn to that community and to those kids from the beginning, and so I did, you know, wind up completing the trip, but I actually looped back around and spent a few more days in Navajo, and I was just hooked and wound up coming back there and shooting the film.
A beautiful place. Plus, Thomas has that whole Mohawk thing going for him.
Exactly. I mean, visually, you know, you couldn't hope for anything more.
Yeah, right. It really stands out.
Exactly.
In the film, and it's beautifully shot, the landscape is like a character. And I don't think you can shoot in anywhere in New Mexico and not have the landscape as part of the film as almost a character. Was that conscious on your part, or is it just because you're in New Mexico shooting, can't help it?
No, it actually was conscious. The land is breathtaking, and especially for me coming from New York, from the East Coast, I had never, you know, seen a landscape like that before, and it is just striking. From the minute you drive into the town of Navajo, there's this single road, and there are these red mesas jutting up into the sky, and I mean, it's really incredible. And because, you know, the Navajos, unlike a lot of other tribes, actually live on their ancestral land. And so, you know, for them, it's so important, you know, their connection to the land, to the earth, to, you know, a place that has been theirs for centuries is really vital. And that's part of what these kids are grappling with, is leaving behind a place that is physically so important to them. And so I did want that to come across, that they were leaving behind not just their family and their friends, but, you know, they were considering leaving behind a place, like a very place that they really, really felt a connection to, a deep connection to. And so I really wanted to bring that out in the film.
Yeah, one of the kids made the comment that it was their grandmother's land, but it was really all of their land.
Right.
Which,
right. Yeah, Thomas says that. Yeah. And, you know, I think that is very much how the community sees it, that this land belongs to them all, and they feel a really deep-seated pride in that.
How did the rest of the community accept you being there and filming?
People were actually quite welcoming and really kind of embraced me, which was lovely and wonderful. I know that there's, you know, a lot of people kind of have the impression that, you know, the Native community is very wary of outsiders, and I think that that can be true. Mm-hmm. But I spent so much time there, and that was intentional. You know, I really wanted to get to know people and give them the chance to get to know me and sort of trust the project and trust, you know, what we were doing and feel comfortable with it. And I think that spending so much time out there, I was out there in totality for about 6 months, really made it possible to tell a more intimate and personal story. And, you know, I thought the community was just incredible. I mean, they really, you know, kind of welcomed me and invited me to birthday parties and sporting events and dinners. And, you know, it was really an incredible experience to be able to become part of the community in such, you know, an intimate way.
Right. And in filming, was there any time, documentaries are, I think, particularly difficult because you're kind of in a situation where you are documenting life, but there are sometimes, a moral urge to participate in some form. Did that happen?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you're 100% right. It is very difficult to strike the right balance between, you know, being a documentarian and kind of being a fly on the wall and wanting to jump in and get involved, especially when, you know, you're there for so long and you really feel, you know, you've formed a relationship with these people. And so especially with the kids, you know, being 17, 18 years old, there were absolutely times where I just wanted to, like, put down the camera and say, you know, do this or don't do that or don't speak to somebody that way or don't treat somebody that way. And, you know, because, you know, you care about them. You're there for such a long time. And so it's tough. It's tough to strike that balance. You know, and there were obviously a lot of time that I spent there when the camera was off,
sure,
you know, hanging out with the kids and spending time with their families. And so, you know, that's always tricky, I think, for anybody, any documentarian, but did the best we could.
Yeah. Did you ever have any of the participants saying, well, how come you can't help us with this?
Well, I mean, there were, you know, a lot of things. You know, my associate producer, Ian, and I actually took the kids on a college trip to NAU and just kind of took a road trip because, you know, their families just weren't, unfortunately, able to, you know, take the time off to take them there to see the school. And so, you know, we did stuff like that when we were able to. So, no, I don't think that there was so much a sense of, like, why can't you do this or why can't you do that? But, you know, certainly, like, the line blurred, and I think expectations, you know, blurred. You know, the kids would sometimes, like, show up in our trailer in the morning and be like, okay, we're here for breakfast. Like, okay. You know, yeah, let's make some pancakes.
Yeah, right. One of the things that for me was kind of profound was the decisions the kids were making based on whether their parents had enough money to pay for the gas to come visit them at the college, and those sorts of for a lot of us kind of mundane things were very, very important for them in where they decided to go to school.
Absolutely. It's a huge factor. And, you know, it's something that really all of the kids took very seriously into consideration. For Tamara, you know, she went to, you know, is hoping to go to school in Durango, Colorado, which is about 4 hours from Navajo, where she lives. And so, you know, even the prospect of her parents having to drive her there and then, you know, subsequently pick her up for, you know, doctor's appointments or dental appointments or anything else that she might need at home and drive her back and forth. I mean, every time that's a tank of gas, and that's a serious consideration. And, you know, that's something that a lot of kids don't need to factor in, you know, don't have to factor in. And for Thomas, I think it was even more profound because he was looking at going to Eastern, which is clear on the other side of the state, on the Texas border. And he realized that if he went there, you know, his dad would probably never be able to visit him. He would probably never have, you know, the ability to get over there. And it would be very difficult for Thomas to come home and visit. And, you know, so those are very serious factors that, you know, I think a lot of kids don't necessarily need to take into consideration.
Right. Well, it's a beautiful film. We're about out of time. Can people see it somewhere, or is there a website people can get more information?
Absolutely. It is streaming on POV's website, on TBS, and the film's website is upheartbreakhill.com. We're also on Facebook. You can like us to get updates, and the film will be available in DVD in just a couple of weeks on shoppbs.org.
Terrific. Eric, I really appreciate it, and congratulations. You just recently got married and met your husband on set, right?
That's right. Yep, I did. I met my husband pretty much the week I started filming, so it's been a crazy summer, but very good. All good things.
Well, good luck to you, and thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you so much. Take care.
This is New Mexico Film Works on Talk 1260 KTRC Radio. We'll be right back with John Armijo. This is New Mexico Film Works on Talk 1260 KTRC Radio, and we're back with John Armijo, who's talking about films from the 1950s. Hi, John.
Howdy.
What do you got?
Well, today we'll wrap up the 40s, but first, Dirk, I'd like to report that we have another devout listener. This makes, what, 4 or 5?
It's incredible numbers.
I bumped into my friend Gayo, who I hadn't seen in a couple of years. New Mexico Magazine should do a story about him. Gayo is one of the best blacksmiths in New Mexico and a heck of a sculptor, and he's a native from beautiful Monticello, New Mexico, over in Sierra County. Anyway, he told me he listens to our show all the time. Thank you, Gayo.
That's great to hear. Thanks, Gayo.
Well, let's begin with the World War II drama Sundown, produced by United Artists in 1941. This is considered to be one of the 100 greatest classic films of all time. It was directed by Henry Hathaway and stars Gene Tierney. Acoma Pueblo doubles for a village hidden deep in the African jungle, and Red Rock State Park and Shiprock double for other East African geography. How about this for a Française-Canadian connection? In 1941, Gene Tierney, married Frenchman Oleg Cassini, who she divorced in 1946, to date John F. Kennedy, who did not want to marry Tierney, but did want to marry Jacqueline Bouvier, who later chose Oleg Cassini to be her couture designer. Oleg Cassini, by the way, served in the United States Coast Guard and in the United States Army during World War II. Pursued, a Warner Brothers film noir Western made in 1949, was voted one of the top 100 Westerns by the Western Writers of America. It was directed by Raoul Walsh and stars Robert Mitchum and Teresa Wright. The cinematography was by future Oscar winner James Wong Howe, who began his illustrious career in 1923 with a silent film, Drums of Fate. Drums of Fate starred silent film star Mary Miles Minter, whose brilliant young career ended after the film was finished, never to appear in film again. She was 20 years old. The reason was because of the William Desmond Taylor murder scandal, which implicated her as the murderer, but was never convicted of the crime. Miss Minter died in 1984 at the age of 82. I think one of the best Westerns made in the 40s was Streets of Laredo. Filming was done around Crown Point and Gallup and at Red Rock State Park. Starring in the film were MacDonald Carey, William Bendix, Mona Freeman, and William Holden. The title was inspired by the ballad of the same name. Here are the first two verses. As I walked out in the streets of Laredo, as I walked out in Laredo one day, I spied a young cowboy all wrapped in white linen, wrapped up in white linen and cold as a clay. Second verse, I see by your outfit that you are a cowboy. These words he did say as I slowly walked by. Come sit down beside me and hear my sad story, for I'm shot in the chest and today I must die. Sad song. Here's a happier version of the second verse sung by the Kingston Trio. I can see by your outfit that you are a cowboy. I see by your outfit you are a cowboy too. You see by our outfits that we are both cowboys. Get yourself an outfit and be a cowboy too. Sons of New Mexico is a contemporary Western made by Columbia Pictures in and around Roswell and in particular at the New Mexico Military Institute, also known as NIMI. The film was made in 1949 and stars Gene Autry, Gail Davis, Russell Arms, and Clayton Moore. Three future television stars emerged from the film. In 1949, Clayton Moore became the Lone Ranger and played him in movies and on television until 1969. Gail Davis was the star of the Annie Oakley TV series. Davis was a professional writer and trick shot and performed at Gene Autry's rodeo and played opposite him in numerous movies and TV shows. And Russell Arms was a regular on the 1950s TV show Your Hit Parade. NIMI has been the learning tree for the children of actors Joel McRae and Francis D. Robert Walker's son was there, and Jennifer Jones' son attended when she was married to David O. Selznick. Barbara Stanwyck's son also attended NIMI, as did Shirley Temple's brother. A more recent graduate of the class of 1987 was actor Owen Wilson. Sons of New Mexico premiered simultaneously at the Plains Theater in Roswell and at NIMI's Pearson Auditorium. Okay, Dirk, take out your songbook. Your Hit Parade was a super popular TV show that ran from 1950 to 1959. Every Saturday night, Russell Arms and three other series regulars sang the seven top-rated songs of the week. Who were the other three vocalists?
Oh, John.
Okay. Dorothy Collins, Snooky Lanson, and Giselle McKenzie. The closing theme song went something like this. So long for a while, that's all the songs for a while. So long to your hit parade and the songs that you picked to be played. So long. So long, Dirk.
John, I want to hear you actually sing those, but I'll wait until I get back to the office.
Yeah, I'll be totally out of tune.
Yeah, okay. Thanks so much, John.
You bet. Bye.
And I just want to shout out to one of our other listeners, Michael. Thanks for listening. And I want to put on your radar, all you folks, some of the movies that some of the independent filmmakers in New Mexico are working on. One I just heard about this morning, Montanza. Some folks from Albuquerque are going to be filming up in the Cuba, New Mexico area. Beautiful area up there. Dead Billy, Scott Milder is going to be coming up. And Hannah McPherson's working on one that I'm sorry I don't have the title for. And A Place to Stand is a film about a Española drug dealer turned poet after going to jail. And that'll be out there sometime soon. Also want to say to congratulations to Don Gray and his crew for winning 4 awards from the 48-hour film project, including Best Picture. So congratulations to you, to all you guys. There's a lot of stuff going on out there in New Mexico film-wise. You can always come to our Facebook and check out what we've got posted. You can also get more information on our website, nmfilm.com. You can hear this radio show streaming on Saturdays at santafe.com. Check for the streaming live link, and also look for the podcast that's available. Go to santafe.com and look for the podcast for Talk 1260 KTRC Radio. You've been listening to New Mexico Film Works. I'm your host, Dirk Norris, and we'll talk to you later.
This ain't no place for the weary kind. This ain't no place to lose your mind. This ain't no place to fall behind. Up your crazy